Okay.
We'll have the door open now. So
we'll have the door open. I'll be pontificating to all of Uppsala. Well, first of all, let me thank everyone for inviting me, and also for all of you who are still sticking with it after the first day and after Phil's talk, where by now you should be completely discouraged and, you know, plan your career move right now while you still can. But what I want to do here in the time available to me, and maybe I'll go under 40 minutes, that might be, people might appreciate that, is to start off, first of all, I mean, Phil in a way threw down the gauntlet about the relationship between science studies and neoliberalism, and in a sense this is an issue very much directed toward me, because the project that I've been engaged in now for the last quarter century, social epistemology, has been very self-consciously about, right, the social production and distribution of knowledge understood in the broad sense of social, which includes the political economy and things of that kind. And I have been monitoring the developments going on and have talked very explicitly about the political and economic dimensions of science. And I have identified with science and technology studies during this period. But what makes me quite different, I think, from a lot of the people in science and technology studies, and in a way makes me nearly as much of a pariah, but probably just about as much of a pariah as Phil is in the science technology studies community, is that I'm very explicitly normative in my orientation toward the study of knowledge. So you have to, and I'm going to just very briefly say a little bit about my intellectual background, because I think now that I've been doing this for 25 years, there is a new generation on board who might not realize where exactly I'm coming from in the first place, especially if you only know about me in my later incarnations. But I'm someone who's trained in history and philosophy of science from the University of Pittsburgh, right? Positivism's last stand. And I come in with a very strong normative orientation toward my understanding of science and knowledge, but not the normative orientation that was present at Pittsburgh, a much sort of broader gauge normative orientation that brings in a lot of the elements that Aunt Elzinga was alluding to. So from the very beginning, I've been very sympathetic to Bernalist, sort of science directing, science steering, and always thought about science policy very much in that vein, right, from the standpoint of the research policy office or for someone who's directing a research unit. And in a sense, that's how I imagined the philosopher of science or the epistemologist to be. You know, maybe in a somewhat more abstract version, but basically a science policy maker of some sort. Now, in that context, the sort of science and technology studies that sort of started to come on board in the 1970s, in the wake of Kuhn, and, you know, we alluded to the sociology of scientific knowledge and all the things after that, that we nowadays normally think of as being dovetailing with neoliberalism, I saw that, you might say, as a kind of corrective, a temporary corrective, because one of the things that science and technology studies did do, and in a way continues to do well, is, as it were, tell you the facts, tell you what it's like out there in the real world of doing science, in all the various sites in which science is done. And one of the problems with the old Mertonian view, or any kind of normative view of science, was it tended to idealize what was happening. And see, the point is, if you have a normative orientation where you're actually trying to realize some values and some ideals, if all you're ever doing is talking about the ideals and kind of ignoring what's happening on the ground, you're not making any contact in any kind of useful way. And that was a very obvious point to me starting in the 1980s. Okay? And from that standpoint, science and technology studies looked like a breath of fresh air. Now, the problem, of course, is that most of the people who got engaged in science and technology studies, and I think this is true especially of the major players who sort of inspired everybody, is that they took the fact that, let's say, science doesn't live up to the sort of Mertonian ideals as a kind of falsification of the Mertonian ideals. Right, as a kind of empirical test, and not just the Mertonian ideals, but all the other philosophical ideals of scientific rationality. It was taken, and when we talk about the naturalistic turn in philosophy, there's a sense in which a lot of the philosophers kind of internalize that too. So those of you who are philosophers of science or know how the field is going, know that, and, you know, nowadays we don't even talk about philosophy of science as such. We talk about philosophy of the sciences. That's already a concession, right, to the way in which we have all this plurality, we have this diversity, and it all defies all the classical norms of knowledge and science, and they have been falsified, therefore. And so, in a sense, what's your normative position? Well, in a sense, the normative position starts to track what in social science methodology is called grounded theory. Right? So in other words, you're only as normative as the agents you're studying are normative. There is no higher level of normativity. It's a bit like what the neoliberals are on about, right? In the sense that in the market environment where you have a marketplace of ideas, each agent in the market knows best what they're thinking. There is no second order perspective that has a better point of view, right? That might be called market intelligence. No, the market intelligence is just an emergent property of the individuals interacting with each other. That is very much a science studies position. So what that doesn't allow you really is any kind of second order normative perspective, which is the thing that is common to the Marxists, the Keynesians, the Mertonians, the Popperians, you name them. They all shared that second order notion, which then provided them a certain vantage point from which they could say what is actually happening in science today is wrong, or is in some way deviant, or it should be going some other place. And see, that's what we lack nowadays, is any kind of, you know, normative pole star in terms of which we can start talking about, you know, we have deviated from where we ought to be, and maybe this is how we should get back to where we ought to be. That sort of discourse is lacking now, and part of it is because people don't believe in it ontologically. Right? They don't believe there's such a that is a really possible thing. And this, I think, is very much part of the ontology and epistemology of neoliberalism that Phil was talking about in his talk. Because people like Hayek are the same way as well. And that's why they're all skeptical of Keynesians or anyone who try to manipulate markets, you know, and be, you know, as if one could have a kind of second order vision of that. Well, the same applies to science. Okay? And that's why, you know, you get comparable sorts of debates about whether the state is in any better position to regulate science than to simply let the scientists kind of look for where their natural point, their natural consumer interests are, where the natural clients are, you know, and they could come from anywhere, public, private, or some combination of public and private. And of course, what you end up getting in that kind of environment is indeed a science that is very much integrated with various social forces, but loses its identity as science altogether. Because what you end up getting is different disciplines, different research areas, funded to varying degrees, moving in different directions in alignment with the various interests of funding them. So this whole logical positivist idea, unified science, or German idealist idea, unified science, that goes out the window, right? Because there is no prior normative perspective in terms of which one could talk about integrating the sciences. Okay? I mean, so I do think that there's a real issue here. Now, my view coming into this, again, in the 1980s, was that science studies was a useful corrective, kind of a second moment in a dialectic, where we had to get to the other side, which was to be normative again, but kind of realistically normative. But that never happened. People just gave up the game. Okay? And that's where we are now, and that's why I think, you know, critiques like Phil's are, in fact, very useful, very kind of the astringent. Right, and exactly the sort of thing that we need now. And there's a kind of put up or shut up moment, it seems to me, and I think Phil was alluding to this at the end of his remarks, because I do think it is true. I think he's absolutely right that if you're a neoliberal, no love is lost over the future of the university. In fact, the university is like one of those badly organized corporations, for example, right, that aren't lean and mean. Right? Any kind of corporate entity that in some sense thinks that it has a life beyond what it can provide from the standpoint of what the market needs, right, is in a way surplus to requirements. And the university can very easily fall into that category. Okay? And in fact, you know, if you think about, well, how does it do it? Well, let's say, you know, when we talk about the Humboldtian university, which is always, in a sense, that's the kind of the burning pole star of the normative perspective, right? It's dying, maybe, but we still have that there. That's at least one place to begin. The key thing about the university as a producer of knowledge has to do with the integration of research and teaching. Okay, that's like, you know, Humboldt 101. And that was to be embodied in each of the individual academics. And that individual academic embodying the ethic of research and teaching was to be a kind of exemplar to the student who, once they've gone through the training, right, would become a freestanding citizen in the society. So there was a reason why, right, for the integration of research and teaching, part of which was for the academic to be a kind of role model for the student. Now, God, we're light years away from that now, right? And not the very least because we have a segmentation of the job market within academia. Right? We got the teachers on one side, we got the researchers on the other side, and never the twain shall meet. Moreover, going to the scientometric stuff, they are measured in radically different ways. So the university is basically a kind of cluster of measures right, that you end up getting a segmented job employment field within the university, which obviously then leads knowledge managers to say, why do all these rather differently employed people, whose performance is measured by rather different standards, what do they have to do with each other, and why do they need to be all housed in the same entity? Right? Shouldn't functional differentiation lead to kind of separation within the market? So you have the teaching places, aka diploma mills, you know, and you have the research parks, the science parks. And you don't, and one doesn't have to be interfering with the other's business. Because from the standpoint of the market logic, right, a teacher who has to do research, right, is not going to be as efficient vis-a-vis the teaching. We're talking about churning out students with credentials. Similarly, right, a researcher who has to teach students, if what you have to do is turn out papers or turn out patents or something like that, is not going to be so efficient if they have to teach students. Okay, so you got both of these things going on. So the question is, so the neoliberal challenge, you might say, the challenge of the market in, logic to the university is, why should it remain a coherent entity in the classical Humboldtian sense? I mean, we already know that it's being torn apart. I mean, so the facts are pretty obvious, and everybody's been going through it all over and over again. But why should we be defending it? And how are we going to defend it? And what aspects of it do we want to defend? Because even those of us who defend the university are the first ones to, you know, realize that, yes, tenure is, in fact, a very important thing with regard to the university in terms of the status of the academic in all kinds of ways. Nevertheless, the actual people who do have tenure or still have tenure, a lot of them are just deadwood and not very good exemplars for this value. And so the younger people who are always already neoliberal, right? Anyone, right? I think this is the way we got to start looking at this issue, people. I mean, because there are actually some young people in the room, you know, and Aunt Elzinga, you know, nostalgize about Bernal in the 1970s and the student movement and anti-imperialism and all this kind of stuff. But everybody was born here, you know, once Thatcher left office, right? Neoliberalism was already in place by the time most of the younger generation was born. So they don't know what this other fantasy world was beforehand. So in a sense, we have to make the case for that from scratch. And we can't make it on 19th century grounds. And that's the challenge, right? Insofar as we want to continue to defend this thing, this value of the university. Okay? Now, I happen to think that it is very important that there be this kind of unified image of the teacher and the researcher in one person. Okay, and I do think, and I do believe also that this kind of a person, you know, who in a way is kind of looking for original knowledge themselves and then are able to translate it and transmit it in the classroom so that people who have not undergone that sort of specialized learning nevertheless are enlightened by it. That is a very important public function, and it is not going to be exemplified anywhere else in society except by a good university academic in something like the classical mold. So there is a kind of, there is something quite distinct and special about the kind of knowledge that we produce as academics and the way in which we produce it. And that in some way needs to be preserved and reinvented for the 21st century. So that's one point. How long have I been going on? 13 minutes according to what, I got 13 minutes I think, yeah. Yeah, sorry, I was in a trance. No. But the question that, okay, so the next difficult question I think that follows from this, because Phil brought up the magic word democratization, which in a sense I'm surprised hasn't really been featured as much, but of course this is a value that we supposedly hold as, you know, liberal to left academics and so forth. But the question is, can we preserve this kind of classical value of the university in the scale, right, that universities operate on today, where we're expecting 40 to 60% of a generation's cohort to go to an institution called a university? Because, in fact, one of the arguments that the neoliberals have in their pocket is efficiency issues. When you talk about large numbers of people who have to be processed in various ways, it's all very complicated, they're coming from all over the world, they're being circulated around. I mean, can ever, you know, how can you have a Humboldtian model of that? Okay? I mean, no, but so that's the real challenge. Whether if we want to defend something like the Humboldtian ideal of the university, and it'll have to be rebranded in some other way, of course, whether what we're defending is a mass university. Okay? I mean, because one of the things that has happened, and this is part of the result, Phil alluded to it early in his talk, about the market as becoming being seen as the most efficient information processor, and that ending up colonizing people's understanding of what knowledge is, which in a way then allows the kind of universalization of knowledge that the knowledge economy and knowledge society presupposes, in which case the university is only one of many players. And as we think about the markets being segmented for knowledge, the university is never the most efficient player in any market. There's always going to be some, you know, so if it's giving out diplomas, a unit that doesn't have to be involved with teaching, I mean with research, is more efficient. You see, I mean, you can go through the whole thing. So if we're defending something like a classical ideal of the university, can we defend it on a mass scale? Because one of the things that has happened starting in the 1980s and accelerating in the 1990s is that just about everything gets called a university. And in the UK, where I live, right, this is really obvious, where we started from having very few institutions called a university under Thatcher. In 1992, a lot of the old polytechnics and teachers' colleges got to be called universities. And then under Blair, who accelerated the process, New Labour accelerated basically this process we're talking about of neoliberalism, right, another 30 get created. Okay, so 130 universities in the UK now, and the thing is they're all graded according to the same performance measures, right, so they're all treated as if they were the same, and so if they fail, they're failing all by the same standard or they're succeeding by the same standard. Okay. And what this does then, it creates all kinds of diabolical situations in terms of how institutions are supposed to be thinking about themselves, because they're all supposed to be called universities. Now my view about this, one of the things that Phil did not talk about in his talk, but comes out apparently in this new book with Verso that he was alluding to earlier, is this idea about how the neoliberals win and will always win, or at least as far as we know. And this has to do with the idea of having some sense of long-term strategic thinking, which is something that the left totally lacks. And in a sense, we need to think about this quite specifically with regard to how do we defend the university, short-term, medium-term, long-term. And we may need, in fact, quite distinct strategies for each of these time frames. And this is something the neoliberals figured out. And so if you read Phil's stuff on the neoliberals and the anthology he alluded to on the Mont Pelerin Society is a good place to start. Because these guys, Walter Lippmann Colloquium, 1937 or whatever it was, that gets the ball rolling. You've got all these people coming in, rather, you know, elite club of people, academics and so forth. They're thinking through all sorts of time frames, through all sorts of possibilities. They got all sorts of options and possibilities and opportunities covered, and they change their strategies, throughout. But they end up they end up winning the prize in the end. By the time we get to the 1980s. Okay? And I think if we want to defend the university, we have to think in those kinds of terms, where there's a short-term strategy, a medium-term strategy, and a long-term strategy. And I think the reason why in my talk, if you saw the title of my talk, I talked about branding the university, is because at least for the short and medium term, we are in this kind of market environment. And I think one of the values of Phil's critique isn't just to bring doom or gloom, but also to educate you about what it means to operate in a market environment, where a lot of academics, and this includes even academic administrators, are very naive about what's going on. And so in a sense, one of the things you can take from his story is you can be a bit Machiavellian about this, right? But at the same time, think about it in terms of what is distinctive about the university that can be sold that none of these other things can sell. I mean, I really think that, in a sense, as a short to medium term strategy, that's the very important thing. So when one thinks about the classical ideals of the university that I've just been alluding to, how can that sort of thing be repackaged? And then think to yourself, is this something that can be sold en masse, or will it have to be sold boutiquely, or how are you going to do this exactly? And that's a tough issue. And depending on the political economy in which you're operating, whether it's state-driven or whether it's like the United States, where it's very diversified, there'll be different sorts of answers to that. Okay? And then on the back of that, one can think of some longer-term strategies by which the university can determine its fate more generally. Now, what I mean by the university determining its fate more generally isn't just financially, which is an issue, but I also mean in terms of the university, you might say, controlling the field of play in which it's operating, which is what it does not do now. In other words, the university has to get back its position as what you might call the authorizer or legitimator of knowledge in society. It has to regain that, okay, as a long-term strategy, right? Now, what do I mean by that exactly? Well, I don't necessarily mean that the university has to be training everyone, but there is a sense in which I think the university ought to be in the business of validating, evaluating, accrediting, licensing, those kinds of things. So you can't imagine, you know, if we're going to get people, if we're going to expect that people are going to all have, in some sense, tertiary degrees, post-high school degrees, right? They're not all going to be from universities of the sort that I wish we should be defending in the long term. But they should come from places that university people would say is actually doing stuff according to the standards that academics think is appropriate. Right? So in other words, we regain the control of the standards. We don't necessarily train everyone, but we're the ones who authorize. And I think that that's the role. Now, you know, if you look at one of the precedents for this kind of move, of course, goes back to the 19th century in England when the Industrial Revolution is taking place, where in fact all the smart people who are coming up with the inventions are operating completely outside the universities. Okay, mechanics colleges, a lot, you know, there are all sorts of issues why this wasn't happening in universities. A lot of them having to do with the fact that, you know, it involved working with your hands, and so that was against the liberal arts. That was already a no-no. But there was also issues of religious dissent and things like that, where if you wanted to go to Oxford and Cambridge, you had to be of the Church of England. And so the Methodists, Baptists, blah, blah, Quakers, etc., they all started their own colleges and things, and a lot of the people who became the great innovators of the Industrial Revolution came from there. But then if you fast forward, let's say, to about 1830 or 1840, you get one of the great intellectual and institutional thinkers about science of the modern period, William Whewell, W-H-E-W-E-L-L, who's both a theologian and a scientist and the master of Trinity College, Cambridge, the man who coins the word scientist in English. And the significance of the word scientist is that scientist implies that you need professional training, right? That it's not enough just to be able to make clever gadgets that work and make money for you, but there's a kind of knowledge and skill that goes beyond just what the mechanic has in his tacit kind of way. That requires book learning. Gets you back to the university, okay? And that book learning would be the knowledge of mathematics and physics and all these kind of formal disciplines that, as it were, are the foundation for this kind of more practical stuff. So the university ends up then becoming the licensor, the accreditor, the authorizer of knowledge that to a large extent had begun outside the university and in a way was beginning to supersede the university's legitimacy. Okay? I think a little bit of that is happening now within information technology. With the information technology innovations happening there, you know, universities are sort of catching up and are not, you know, still have somewhat ambiguous relationship to it in terms of the forms of knowledge that are being produced. But I think, in a sense, what Whewell did, if you look at it in the long term, was he kind of saved the prominence of places like Oxford and Cambridge by incorporating science as part of the curriculum, not because everyone who ended up doing science went there, but because, you know, the authoritative forms of knowledge were being produced there and then accredited and credentialed elsewhere. Now, I know the way I'm telling the story, it sounds incredibly elitist. But then it seems to me, one of the key features of the Humboldtian view of the university from the 19th century was about dynamizing and making a society that was previously backward, right, Prussia, into a world leader, right? It is and to be a dynamizing progressive force is to think about your institution in vanguard terms. So you have to, in some sense, always think of yourself as being ahead of the curve. And at the moment, the universities are acting like anything but that. Okay, the whole tables have been turned on the way in which universities are used to thinking about themselves, and perhaps this is one of the reasons why academics can't quite come to grips with this. Because it's a complete reversal of position. Okay, and I think, this is where it becomes very important to think about what we are defending when we're defending the university and we have a kind of short-term, medium-term, long-term strategy. You know, in the old days of the welfare state, I don't know what it was here, but in most places, it wasn't that 50 or 60% of the people were being subsidized by the taxes. It was a relatively small percent of the people, and then there was some sense that those people who got subsidized to go to universities, they would be producing things that would have a kind of like a multiplier effect of benefiting society after a generation or two. Okay? That was kind of the justification. The justification was in terms of a very long-term horizon of what the value of having state funding for higher education was. It wasn't a matter of you need to go to into university to get a job credential which you otherwise would not have. It, in other words, the ultimate payoff of the university wasn't seen in some such short-termist terms. It was part of a longer-term economic horizon, you know, where you imagine that in the short term, yes, a few people are getting the education, but what they do in the long term ends up benefiting the society. So you have a kind of long cycle view of what's going on. Now, I'm not saying that this is ideal, but this was at least sustainable economically, because then you're not talking about subsidizing everybody through the taxpayer. Okay, so I do think, you know, this goes back to the point of what is the exact point of saying that everyone should be going to a university. As well. Now, I think there are other subsidiary issues that start to arise if you want to suddenly defend a kind of elite notion of the university, and that is what its relationship is to the state, for example, which traditionally provided a lot of the political backing that enabled the universities to be these authoritative places. Also, there's an issue about, okay, let's say you as it were, pull back the notion of the university, and you say that there, you know, only half or a third of the institutions currently called universities will be universities in the future. Then what is the status of the other institutions? And in particular, if you are interested still in democratic ideals, you know, and citizens being empowered, then universities do need to take an interest in what's being taught in those other institutions. Okay, so there's a kind of custodial role, you might say, with regard to those other institutions. It's not just that you leave them to the market to do whatever, right? So this is part of a kind of a general plan for reviving the fortunes of the university. Let's see, I got 26 minutes here that I seem to have gone on, so I got a few more minutes, right? Okay, I'm looking at the recorder here. Now, there are a few issues that have been already touched on in the conference that are also part of the problems with trying to address this agenda that I'm talking about. And one of them, I think has been brought up quite a lot, is the lack of interest in by academics in defending or even being related very much to the university. Okay, that's a real clear problem. And I think and in a sense, you see, this is where, you know, the kind of disdain or ignorance of higher administration of the university by the more traditional academics, I'm not talking about the younger people, but by the more traditional people, in a way, you know, sends a kind of signal to the younger people where it's like, okay, if I'm going to be a good academic, what I really should be thinking about is just my research, you know, and I should be working on that. And that should be, as it were, the level at which my affiliation should end almost, right? What makes me an academic is I'm working in this discipline or maybe in this network of other researchers. And you see, once you're at that deinstitutionalized consciousness of academic life, then it becomes very easy to be a neoliberal, right? Because if you're able to do the kind of research you want to do, you don't care whether it's in a university or a science park or up in a tree, whoever's paying for it, right? There's a sense in which the institutional context in which you're doing the work doesn't matter as long as they just allow you to get on with it. Right, the natural sciences, I mean, it exhibits this a lot, but I think, of course, this could happen to all the disciplines. So there's a sense in which academics need to reaffiliate with the university, okay, and identify with it as part of what they are, right? They are defenders of the university. Now, this is very tricky. I do not expect all academics to become administrators. Of course not. I mean, we don't need more bureaucrats. We need better bureaucrats, okay? But what I think it is important is that those of us who are not in administration be supportive of enlightened people and encourage enlightened people to go into administration. Okay? And indeed, one of the things that I would say is that, you know, an interesting kind of academic curricular task would be to develop a kind of higher degree, you know, whereby one has to display competence in higher education administration other than having run a soap factory. Okay, so in other words, there's something more to being a competent higher education administrator with regard to values and normative orientation that goes beyond just being able to balance the books and bringing in more money. And academics should sort of be committed to that kind of idea to the point of even thinking about certifying people. So some people are ineligible to apply for the job because they are not of the right kind. Okay? I mean, I think there should be something going on like that. So I'm not saying everybody should be an academic administrator, but we have to support academic administration, because if we're talking about the future of the university as an institution, we have to think about how is that institution going to be reproduced over time intact? And at the moment, we are sending out no signals, certainly no positive signals, to the younger generation that they should be affiliating to the university as an institution. Because even the people who are excellent researchers are spending most of their time at home or standing in a podium like this, where I'm not even at my university, and that doesn't send a good signal. Okay? So this is something that I think we really, so at a concrete level, that's one thing we need to do. The other thing I think we need to do, I'll wrap it up here, is that we really need to get the... I mean, I don't know what the relationship is between the students and the faculty here, but I do think we need to get the student body more on board with the positive value of the university. That in some sense, the academics and the students should be seen as being on the same side. One of the problems of neoliberalism is this kind of consumer culture, right? Which ends up pitting the academic against the student in a market environment. Right, where in some sense, we as academics are doing what we can do to placate the student, and the student is always looking to see whether they're really getting their money's worth. So there's this kind of, cat and mouse thing going on as in the relationship between the academic and the student. And this is completely unhealthy and completely against the spirit of what the university is about, where the student should be on side with the academics, all together moving forward to a self-determining future, if I may still use that Humboldt language. But at the moment, we are a house divided against itself. Okay? So again, these are very kind of concrete things. One of the things that I mentioned I provided an article to the commentator, which I've liberally drawn on. but one of the things that... But one of the things that I talk about is an idea that is now getting some vogue in Britain, and it's kind of an interesting idea, and it's maybe you have it here, called the co-curriculum. The co-curriculum. And that is basically the ability of students. So students have the students' unions, student activities, things of that kind, and looking at the kinds of epistemically worthwhile things they might be doing outside the classroom, and in some way incorporating them into the curriculum, or at least giving the students credit for that. And I imagine this primarily in the areas of information and communication technology. There have been some universities that, for example, have tried to bring students on board in terms of digital curation, where you get into some very interesting discussions, not just in the mechanical transmission of information from books, into digital media, but also, what is to be preserved, how to preserve it, what are the principles by which things can be searched. These are all intellectually challenging tasks. Very often the students spontaneously, right, already kind of know the technology, they know how to do this stuff, they're sort of doing it on their own for fun, and academics are often very clueless about this. And this is a kind of knowledge students spontaneously develop and could be made part of a co-curriculum. I mean, I'm just giving you this as one example. But in any case, we need to sort of have the students on board with us, because we can't really present ourselves as a future-looking institution, the university, unless we do have the students on our side naturally, as knowledge producers, just like we are. Because at the moment, one of the reasons why, this is why we look so backward, right? Because the students are obviously taken for granted as the future. And then the question is, where are we with them? And we haven't defined an appropriate position with regard to that, except to be kind of mildly resistant. Okay? So I'll stop there. All right?